We will be proceeding in moments as council approach and get themselves ready. The second of three oral arguments, the first two here at the Judicial Center, one following that via Zoom. Judges Yorkman and Smith join me, Judge Sleater, in the second matter, A23-1397. State of Minnesota is the respondent. Keith Ashley Doering is the appellant. And as council likely is aware, each side will have, party will have 15 minutes. We do ask that you identify yourself for the record because we are recording the proceeding as well as live streaming. No other recording is allowed, but we will have an audio recording on the judicial branch as well, 24 hours. So that's the reason we ask you to identify yourself, who you represent, and then, of course, appellant will council will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So when you're ready, counsel for appellant, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Keith Doering, in this matter. This case hinges on the difference in the analysis between an identified informant who's giving tips to law enforcement versus comments by strangers, and how law enforcement can rely on those tips in determining whether there's a sufficient basis to seize somebody and how we look at that after the fact. As the court, and I don't want to repeat the brief too much, but there's two basic types of informants. There's identified and there's unidentified. Even unidentified first-time informants kind of get a pass because we know that there's the chance, like most people aren't going to lie to the police, or at least that's the theory. They're eligible to be penalized for filing a false police report. So this situation is far removed from that. We did have the identified informant, but she made no statements of her own based on her personal observations regarding intoxication.
Although you can overhear in the 911 call, you can hear the other driver, can't you? I mean, I think that voice you can hear on that. Does that make a difference?
You could not. It was listed as inaudible, inaudible, inaudible. The one time somebody else could be heard was saying, we're going to call 911. And then the identified caller responded, I'm on the phone with them right now. And then it was immediately after that, there was something else inaudible. And then the identified caller says, apparently, the guy is really, really drunk. So that really, really drunk statement, that was relied on by the district court in finding that there was a reasonable, articulable suspicion sufficient to seize. But it wasn't made by an identified caller. It wasn't made by somebody who called in at all. It was a comment made by a stranger with no accountability whatsoever. The case law doesn't give that any benefit of the doubt whatsoever. Dispatch shouldn't have, and law enforcement shouldn't have either. And so absent that comment, apparently the guy is really drunk, and then the identified caller even backing away further from that, saying, I'm going to move my car. If he's drunk, like, I don't want to get hit. Like, she clearly wasn't seeing anything that led her to believe he was intoxicated. She wasn't saying he's stumbling. All we had was running and panicking, and the panicking,
The flipped ATV. I mean, that's sort of indicative, or could be consistent with somebody who was intoxicated to the extent there's the flipped over ATV at the end of the driveway.
And yeah, and it could be, but again, we don't even know when it flipped. It could have been there all day. It could have been somebody else driving it. I mean, the fact that it was on private property and we have no timing whatsoever regarding when this incident happened, all we had was the fact that Mr. Doering was doing it after 11 o'clock at night, uprighting it and bringing it back to his property. That's not enough for a reasonable, articulable suspicion. The only other additional information the deputy picked up when he arrived on the scene was after he was further up Doering's property and saw him stumble on an implement in the dark, in the rain. That alone, I don't think that rises to more than a hunch that something was going on, but definitely not enough to where a seizure would be appropriate, especially in light of all of the other evidence. He was driving the tractor normally. He didn't see any stumbling. The deputy wasn't able to corroborate any panicking or running when he was on the scene. Had the deputy spoken with that other individual, and that other individual at the scene had said, yep, I think he's drunk and here's why, completely different case. But that conversation didn't happen. So all we've got is what dispatch told the deputy, and the state's right, we can impute everything that was given to dispatch to the deputy, but what we can't do is treat as reliable comments by a stranger on the scene as though an identified caller with a personal basis to support that conclusion made those statements. That's not what happened here.
You make a good point that if you look at each individual fact, circumstance, that alone wouldn't be sufficient, but we look at the totality, do we not? And so part of the credibility was when the deputy arrives, everything that he did here was from dispatch was confirmed of the flipped ATV, the tractor, a man without a shirt and shorts, I believe it was, and the location and all of that. And so when you start adding all those together with the allegations of drunk, but then seeing the stumbling, you put that together, isn't that at that stage exactly what reasonable articulable suspicion becomes, at least to then do the seizure and do further inquiry?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Almost everything you listed was not even, it was perfectly legal behavior for Mr. Doering to be doing on his property. There were no allegations of injuries or anything like that. It was corroborating innocent behavior. So that doesn't give any additional basis to think, hey, maybe I need to seize this person. And as I stated earlier, I don't think the deputy was allowed to give any credit to the statement really, really drunk because of the way it came about. So that's completely out of the equation. So what we have is a lot of perfectly legal behavior. The fact that the identified caller saw that Mr. Doering was in a hurry and drew the conclusion that he was panicked. And then we've got the deputy's observation on the scene that he stumbled.
Let me pose it just a little bit differently. Would it be your position under the law that the obligation at that point the deputy would have had would be to interview, perhaps it was that other driver of the other vehicle who observed and made the apparent comments about drunk, to inquire what's your basis for believing he's drunk, order to then have, that would have been put it over the top in your opinion, legally.
Yeah, I'm not willing to concede that if the statement really, really drunk comes in, that it's still reliable enough to form a basis to seize, but yes, there are some situations where an officer simply isn't going to have reasonable articulable suspicion to seize no matter what happens, but in this case, it would have been a far stronger argument if he had gotten that information directly from, and maybe additional information, from both of the individuals on the scene. Instead, he relied solely on what came through dispatch. That might not have been the option in a different situation. Both callers may have left, but in this situation, there was definitely an option that would have hewed closer to the dictates of the Constitution, and it would have been conversations with the two individuals to get that information from them. So in this case, I think that's the crux of the issue is how we treat that phrase, really, really drunk. I don't think it can be given any credit, and therefore I don't think under these facts the deputy did have a basis to seize Mr. Doering at the time he did. That's why we're asking the court to reverse the decision of the district court. If there are no other questions from the panel, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Appears to be none. Very well. Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, you may approach, identify yourself, and then begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ken Jansen. I am the attorney for the County of McLeod. As counsel outlined, this appeal, it boils down to the reliability of the informant. Whether or not we can rely upon the statement that, one, that the driver was really, really drunk, and all the other information she provided to dispatch. And I think it's easy to leave that part out of it. But I will start with we have this third party, and that third party is unidentified. I agree with that. But I would disagree with counsel that in and of itself makes those statements unreliable and law enforcement unable to use that in their determination that there was, in fact, a reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity. The listening to that 911 audio is quite clear that the caller was frantic. There was a lot of stuff ongoing, that she was yelled at by the other driver, get back in your vehicle. She was told that the other driver was really, really drunk. Looking at this just from a trial hearsay point of view, that in and of itself, I would argue, would be admissible at trial as an excited utterance under the hearsay standard, that it's determined to be reliable under those circumstances. So now to argue that we can't even consider that for a reasonable articulable suspicion standard, I think at this point, looking to the totality of those circumstances, that it's not consistent with the case law.
Wouldn't it, just clarify, wouldn't the excited utterance come from the person who actually uttered it initially, because she's uttering what someone else uttered? Does that really fit?
So I think so. I think that, so we have Emma Carlson, she was the caller. She was told by this unidentified other driver that was parked on the scene to get back in your vehicle. He's really, really drunk. And I think that at trial, she would have been able to testify to that, or I believe at least there would be a valid argument for that hearsay to come in.
Right. I mean, it might come in just as non-hearsay. If the point is there reasonable articulable suspicion, it doesn't matter the truth of the matter asserted in there. So it might not even be a hearsay problem at all if that's the purpose of putting it in. But I think the argument is that this is secondhand, is that, you know, if we look at the Rose case, our Court of Appeals case, it says there's basically two factors when you have an informant. You have to, is the informant identified, which lends reliability? And then even so, are there facts supporting the assertion that the driver is under the influence? And here, you have two people present there, one of whom perhaps the other person, if I like apply Shepherd, could infer that the other person saw something that made them conclude that we know that person is there observing, that made them conclude that that person is drunk. But then we have this remove where they didn't ask, the caller, besides hearing it, how do you know that? Did you observe it? This case seems different from all the other ones in that we have someone who presumably observed something to believe that they're really drunk, which looks like a Shepherd case, but then it's removed a step because it's the caller who's identified saying, oh, I heard he's really, really drunk.
And I think it goes a little bit beyond that, too. I think there are supporting factors that we can look to that bolster the credibility and reliability of that third party. One is that third party did stick around. There was the two vehicles that were parked at the scene when law enforcement did arrive at the scene of the accident. The reporting party, Ms. Carlson, she also reported to law enforcement that she observed that the driver, he was covered in mud. This appeared, she reported, she thought it just happened. This is a busy highway, Highway 212, going through the middle of McLeod County, and there's a flipped ATV parked or upside down in the ditch of this major highway. This is not it's not unreasonable for her to come to this conclusion that this accident just happened. The driver's right there, the flipped vehicle. She's seeing all this happen. She's seeing this driver. He's running frantically. He runs up to the garage, gets his tractor, drives it back, and in a hurried and panic manner, he flips the ATV back over. So much so, he's acting in this frantic manner that Ms. Carlson reported to law enforcement or to dispatch that she had to move her vehicle out of the way as she feared that she was going to be struck by this frantic driving and this conduct. So I believe that it goes a little bit more than just Ms. Carlson was told by this other driver that he's really, really drunk, but she also made these observations that corroborated what she was told. And I think when it boils down to it, you know, what do we expect out of Ms. Carlson? She's yelled at by this other driver to get back in her vehicle. He's really, really drunk. We don't expect her to go up, investigate this manner, determine, all right, he is drunk, make these independent observations. She can report that to law enforcement. Law enforcement is there to investigate that. That's what they are meant to do. So looking at then what law enforcement comes upon, law enforcement, they come upon both vehicles. They come upon Ms. Carlson, who's parked on the street. They come upon another vehicle that's parked, just as was reported by Ms. Carlson. Now, I acknowledge that Deputy Robbins certainly could have spoken to that other driver before making contact, but under those circumstances, I don't think that would have been appropriate. That driver was driving his tractor away from the scene, driving up the driveway, away from the scene when law enforcement arrived. The law enforcement had an obligation to follow, see what was going on. There wasn't time to start gathering information, to start taking statements from witnesses. We had Mr. Doering continuing to drive up his driveway away from the scene of this accident. And the deputy rightfully followed up the driveway. He then made an independent observation. Mr. Doering get off the tractor, and he stumbles around, stumbles over some farm equipment in his yard. That corroborated that he was, in fact, intoxicated. At that point, the deputy makes the comment, hey, come over here. He had that ability and lawfully was able to ask, come over here, to continue that investigation.
You acknowledge that the, hey, come over here, was a seizure for purposes of the court's analysis, correct?
I'm not challenging that at this point. It was challenged at the motion hearing at what exactly point that happened. I acknowledge that at that point, the driver was no longer free to leave. I think the deputy testified to that. He was going to continue the investigation, determine what was happening. I think at that point, it certainly could be argued that the deputy was just checking into the situation. There was a fresh crash on a major highway in the middle of McLeod County, and he was able to investigate that matter, determine whether or not Mr. Doering was in fact hurt or others were involved. I think he has that right to ask those questions at the scene of a crash.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that none of the reports and none of the deputy's observations were of illegal, conduct that was in and of itself illegal?
Well, Your Honor, I guess that in and of itself I don't think matters. Looking to the totality of the circumstances, the law enforcement is able to use 100% totally lawful conduct in making a determination that criminal activity is afoot. So for instance, smelling of alcohol, stumbling, all those, that in and of itself, that is not illegal behavior. But when you start adding that stuff up, is how we get that totality of the circumstances. Would an objective person believe, would it be reasonable to conclude that there's criminal activity afoot? And I would argue in this circumstance, it is clear that with that call that came in, the information that was provided to dispatch, there's a fresh crash on Highway 212, the officer or the deputy was able to come upon the scene, corroborate much of what he was told. He came upon that fresh scene of an accident. The two vehicles were still there. Mr. Doering was shirtless, covered in mud, driving his tractor up to the house away from the ATV that was just pulled over. That all lines up with what was relayed to dispatch. And then the deputy followed Mr. Doering and made that independent observation at that point of him stumbling. And at that point, he made that comment, hey, come over here.
Counsel, isn't party missing, and maybe from your answer to Judge Bjorkman's question, is again, each one of those activities, you know, flipping an ATV in itself is an accident, and driving a tractor on his own property, obviously legal, and et cetera. So isn't the real issue here is whether he believed he was impaired at the time of the accident. So wouldn't it behoove, and that was the focus, I'm assuming, from the deputy, is really undisputed, wouldn't it behoove the officer to corroborate the key fact of why they thought he was drunk and talk to that other driver? Tell me why you think he was so drunk. What did you observe? That would at least then close up the real law violation that he articulated as reasonable.
And I like I said, I the deputy certainly could have done that. He certainly could have gone to the witnesses, taken statements at that point.
But my question is, I don't need a formal statement because we're just at the reasonable articulable suspicion at this point, and it was right for him to investigate it. But really, the bottom line, he was investigating a possible driving while impaired, given the flipped over ATV and the comments that were made. So wouldn't that not just be a could, but he should have corroborate the key fact that ties it into a law violation?
Well, at that point, I believe that he, under those circumstances of Mr. Doering driving up the driveway and going back up to the house, that under those specific circumstances, that the deputy had an obligation to continue following this perpetrator of a crime. There were other...
Crime of driving while impaired.
Yes.
That's why I kind of keep coming back to that, because as we've been talking about, all the individual circumstances in and of themselves are lawful unless and until, of course, the impairment, the he's really drunk. And so that's why I was trying to ask you, doesn't the law require him to corroborate that? Because that really hasn't been corroborated yet independently.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the law enforcement, they can rely upon this tip. There's several cases out there where, for instance, the Pale versus Commissioner of Public Safety, as well as the Shepherd case that we point out in the brief. So I won't get too deep into it, but where a caller simply calls in, for instance, working at Burger King or working at a gas station, an employee says, all right, I observed this person. They are really drunk. Or they're drunk, and they drove off in this direction. With that, the courts have consistently held that that is enough to make a stop, that law enforcement should not wait around and wait for something for this individual to screw up to give them that ability to make that stop, that they can rely upon that tip and make that stop and then have that investigative seizure to confirm. So in this instance, I would argue that the tip was reliable, that it could be relied upon based upon that the parties stayed at the scene, law enforcement came upon, and was able to corroborate much of what was going on. At that point, I believe that that tip was reliable, and in and of itself, law enforcement was able to make a stop based off of that tip. It looks like I've run out of time there. I appreciate your time.
You timed it just perfect, the end of your answer.
Thank you very much.
Counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it again please the court. Appellant's position in this case is that the state can't sanitize the statements made from this stranger on the scene through the case law that allows for identified callers to make the same statements. There's just a couple of facts that came up in respondent's argument. The first is trying to put any illegal impotence on the fact that Mr. Doering was muddy. I mean, it was a rainy day, and he was getting under the ATV to hook up the tractor to it. So again, muddy is just another one of those facts that's completely innocent behavior. It's like saying somebody walking in the rain had wet hair. Well, that's not going to raise any suspicion. It could give you a hunch. You could whimsically think something's up, but it doesn't rise to the level of a seizure, even standing alone or in conjunction with a dozen other facts. But what I really want to focus on is the state's arguing that this was a fresh crash and that it just happened. And there's no basis in the record to state that. The only thing that was said was by the identified caller when she was talking about the other person on the scene, and it was literally just as she arrived. It's one of her first comments to dispatch where she says, "I guess they saw it," or "I'm guessing they saw it." Like, that's not enough of a basis to say this is a fresh crash. And then finally, I didn't see any arguments at the district court that there was an exigency or a hot pursuit situation going on here. So the state's arguments that the deputy was obligated to walk up Mr. Doering's driveway and confront him versus interviewing witnesses that could actually cement a sufficient basis to seize, I don't think that's an appropriate analysis, you know.
When I look at, I mean, I think that Shepherd is perhaps the most problematic case for you. I mean, it's a gas station attendant who says there's an intoxicated driver. And I think that's about it. And we had held, oh, that's not sufficient. We got reversed by the Supreme Court that decided, well, we will infer that that attendant saw something that made them concerned. I mean, here we have, I mean, there's just no case law where you have sort of a relayed information that is based on someone who's also present there and seeing something. I mean, you could look at Shepherd and say, for example, if it was the guy who was calling and says, oh, I'm at the scene here and I see this and he's really drunk, or I just see this, I think he's really drunk. I'm not even seeing it. I mean, Shepherd would infer that, well, he's seeing something that tells us that. And so, you know, when you hear the guy in the background inaudibly and she's saying, oh, I'm reporting, this is what this guy has said, you know, I don't know that's a big leap for the, and the officer gets there and sees both people are still there, they're presumably providing truthful information because they're remaining on the scene, et cetera, they were both, I can see that they were seeing something, that they're present, they could see this guy. I mean, Shepherd, there's not that much there for the reasonable articulable suspicion, whereas here, arguably, there's more.
And I would argue the reverse, that there is less. Prior to Shepherd, it was very clear that there needed to be, you needed to elicit statements that provided that sort of foundational reliability for just the conclusion somebody was drunk. Shepherd took it a step further and said, again, when we've got somebody who's, you know, choosing to engage with law enforcement and give them information, like if it's based on firsthand knowledge, if they had an opportunity to interact with the person, we're going to assume they saw things that supported that, that they're not just making the bald assertion, exposing themselves to filing a false police report. We're willing to go that extra step.
Right. If the person says he's intoxicated, that seems to be about it. And they really distinguish in Shepherd possibly intoxicated from Olson. And Shepherd is intoxicated. So we will infer that the person saw everything. And it's based on personal observation.
Yes. And it's a whole other level of inference to take that from the person that made the observations to somebody on the scene. I mean, we're making a lot of assumptions there. We're assuming this person actually would have called 911. We're assuming they didn't have an axe to grind. We're assuming they actually saw stuff that would have led to the conclusion that somebody was drunk.
And the reason to assume that, perhaps, is that there's a call where they're both there, they're both still there when the police arrive, that tends to suggest that they're not just some malicious person like calling and saying, hey, you know, person X is drunk with no context whatsoever.
No, and that's true. And then on the flip side, the one identified caller we do have doesn't make any of her own assertions that Mr. Doering is drunk. Doesn't say anything along the lines of he's stumbling, like he's having trouble walking, he's swaying. Like, she makes none of those. And again, she distanced herself saying, you know, if he's drunk, I don't want to be too close. Instead of saying, he looks really drunk to me, too. And so, again, I don't think it's appropriate under the Constitution for the state to sanitize statements that weren't made to dispatch. It shouldn't get the benefit of all the doubt we give to identified informers, as was the case in Shepherd, where the person was identified and identifiable. And so for all those reasons, we are asking this court to reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement now, issue a ruling. Have a good day. We'll be momentarily adjourning to reconvene via Zoom for our third oral argument at 10:55.